This morning our context will be Hebrews the 12th chapter. We've made reference to it recently, but I'd like to go a little bit more in depth into it, starting at verse 18. And the psalm that was just read is a good lead in to it. The thing about the Hebrew book gives us insights into things that we normally don't think about and some of the privileges and responsibilities we have as Christians. And a lot of times we have a tendency to think, you know, not knowing history, that things just go on the way they do. In fact, that was one of the arguments in 2 Peter 3 about people saying that there wasn't going to be an end, you know, coming because it's always been this way. And they overlook the fact of the flood and other things. What we don't realize sometimes as people is that we had a closer relationship with God in the beginning, not only with Adam, but even out of the garden, God was talking directly to the patriarchs of the time. You can imagine yourself as the head of a family or a tribe, and God speaking directly to you. That's what it was with Noah and Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, whatever. But there came a period of time when he ceased doing that. And what marked a change then was Moses taking the people out of Israel and bringing them to this little chunk of rock, Sinai. By agreement, I don't know if this is Sinai. No, they're kind of the tradition, this is, you know, the mountain of Sinai. The Hebrew writer is going to talk about this, but there's some misconceptions too. I mean, when you look at, you know, what happened with the Israelites here, this was a phenomenal bit of difference of God, you know, speaking to the people, but the way he spoke to them was different than people had been spoken to in the past. Now, the comparison is made between this mountain, as we get into this context, and something we have far greater. And there's some misconceptions that, you know, that the Hebrew writer had to clear up for the Jews, and there's some things that we have to clear up for ourselves. First of all, we have a tendency to think of the Jews had Moses and the law, and Christians have Christ in the New Covenant. The Jews had more than Moses and the law. What they had to begin with was Abraham. In fact, the Hebrew writer goes back to Abraham in the 11th chapter and starts talking about the promises and the blessings, you know, that God had made and was doing for Abraham. So that not only impacted them, but also impacts us. Because as Gentiles, for the most part, we also share in the blessings and promises of Abraham. Okay? So we trace both of ourselves back to that. The way it's described, yeah, in my mind, it just flashed into a kind of description of what Mount Sinai was. You know, it was sort of the woodshed to take the, you know, Israelites to kind of, you know, give them a whooping and get them straightened out. Because, you know, Galatians, it says the law was given because of transgressions. Yeah, so these people were taken up to Sinai and kind of put a good scare into them. So it starts off in Hebrews, and this is, you know, in Hebrews, we have not come, you know, perfect participle. That is, you know, the implication is, yeah, they came to Mount Sinai, but they didn't stay there. Okay, that's one of the major differences between what they had and what we have now. In fact, he says, we don't have a mountain, you know, we don't come to a mountain that can be touched. I mean, still there. You can go into the Sinai Desert and you can go to this mountain, you can reach up to it and touch it. Anybody can. It's that common. It's just a rock that sticks up out of the desert. Not very big, we got bigger mountains out here. Okay? But anybody can go touch it. Anybody. It doesn't matter. You know, Christian, Jew, heathen, whatever. You know, it's that common. It was special when God was there, but it's common now. Now, sometimes we carry this over into the church. And he's trying to tell us in this context that a lot of times we don't realize what the church is. If you think, you know, you're coming here, it's just a social gathering, you know, we take a few things and that's it, man, you've missed the point entirely. You have no conception of the grandeur of what the church was intended to be. You haven't come to a mountain that can be touched. Now he goes on to describe what they came to then, why it got kind of scary. You know, not to a blazing fire, not to darkness, gloom, a whirlwind. I mean, when God's presence came on Mount Sinai, it looked like a volcano had just erupted. I mean, there was a fire, a roaring fire on the top of it that looked, you know, like it wouldn't go out. And the pall from the smoke and stuff like that, you know, it caused a darkness during the day, and it was so intense at night it blocked out everything. So when it talks about gloom in our text, the Hebrew word that was used there is greater than darkness. It's blackness. You could see nothing. In the whirlwind, you know, we get fires here in California every once in a while, and you can see the firestorm that's caused by the fire itself. I mean, it causes a wind, and that wind flames up the fire even more. That's what they were looking at. So that takes us through, you know, the first part, you know, verse 18. And look at this. Deuteronomy 4. You know, Moses is trying to describe this. In fact, the Hebrew writer is pulling this out of both Exodus and Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy is the second giving of the law. Okay, he's describing to the young people that grew up after, you know, the journey in the desert, trying to explain to them just how awesome this thing was when God was on Sinai just temporarily. Okay, he said, and you came near and stood at the foot of the mountain, and the mountain burned with fire. I mean, look at that rock. Does that look like it could burn? But it is. So intense was the heat that the rock was melting. Okay, and the mountain burned with fire to the very heart of the heavens. Darkness, cloud, thick gloom. In the fifth chapter, moving on, these words the Lord spoke to all of your assembly at the mountain from the midst of the fire, of the cloud and the thick gloom with a great voice, and he added no more. He wrote them on two tablets of stone and gave them to me. And this is Moses talking. Trying to explain what happened. Now, why didn't he write any more? Well, there were some other things that began to occur. Notice here, you haven't come to a blast of trumpet and the sound of words. Actual word sound there is literally voices. So the Hebrew writer is doing a little interpretation there for us. You know, but in the original, you get things that are going on. The voices of words, which sound was such that those who heard begged. I mean, can you get the picture of how awesome this was? You know, that the sound of God speaking was so terrifying that they begged that he wouldn't talk anymore lest they die. Notice this, Exodus 19. So it came about on the third day when it was morning that there was thunder and lightning flashes and thick cloud upon the mountain and a very loud trumpet sound. I'm not sure where the trumpet sound came from, whether it was from God or the people. It sounds like we know when God comes again, there'll be the sound of trumpet. So some kind of blaring noise that announced something or other that shook the people, so that all the people who were in the camp trembled. We're talking 2 million people like this, just absolutely terrified of what's going on. Back to Deuteronomy, now then, why should we die, the people said, for this great fire will consume us. If we hear the voice of God, of the Lord our God any longer, we shall die. I mean, they're begging him to stop. So terrifying was the presence of God upon Mount Sinai. And it was just a temporary presence. I mean, this is one of the contrasts between where Christians have come and where they had come. They came to a terrifying spot that was just temporary. The presence of God was temporary. This is according to all that you ask of the Lord your God in Horeb, that's Sinai, also another name for it, on the day of the assembly, saying, let us not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see his great fire anymore. Again, worried about dying. Come on. Okay. For they could not bear the command that if even a beast touched the mountain, it was to be stoned. Now, it's kind of interpretive of the impact. You know, he's not quoting word for word, but he's trying to let them know that this mountain had become so holy and the presence of God so severe that the command went out, no one was to approach the mountain. And if they did, not only the beast, but any person was to die. Now, there was going to be an allowance of at least two people we know of that could go up on the mountain, Moses and Joshua. But for the rest of the people, yeah, it became just, yeah, they didn't want to be around this place. From the past. Exodus 19, and you shall set bounds for the people all around, saying, beware that you do not go up on the mountain or touch the border of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall surely be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall surely be stoned or shot through. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. God was there. It was holy ground. And not just anybody could come up. And so terrible was the sight that even Moses said, I am full of fear and trembling. I mean, he was a friend of God. And he couldn't bear what was going on. Now, this incident is when he's coming back down. And what's causing him even more is, I mean, what they're seeing is just how awesome God is, how fearful, how terrible. But what Moses was privy to as he was coming down out of the mountain was the fact of the people's sin. They'd asked Aaron to make him a golden calf. And now it wasn't just the presence of God, it was the anger of God that was developing here. For I was afraid of the anger and hot displeasure with which the Lord was wrathful against you in order to destroy you. But the Lord listened to me that time also. What God wanted to do was completely destroy the Israelites. He wanted to start all over again with Moses. He didn't care it took like 400 and some odd years to develop this nation of people. He was willing to wipe them all out and start with someone he could depend on. And that was Moses. And the only thing those Israelites live is because Moses interjected himself. Now, as we look at the church, okay, don't think of it as just the church, because you have a list here of what it really is in a comparison. You have come to Mount Zion, okay, the city of the living God. Okay, Zion is different than Sinai. Okay, it's a spiritual mountain. In fact, it starts off with the concept of in the location, Jerusalem, the temple site, was built on Moriah. That's where Abraham was going to offer up Isaac to God. That's where the temple was constructed. Zion was the peak that was higher than Moriah, showing its overlord. So God picked that to show he was over everything that was going on. And it came to represent the people of God, the true people of God. And then, as it mentions here, you know, these are descriptions of what Mount Zion is. It's the city of the living God. God didn't dwell permanently on Sinai. God does dwell permanently on Mount Zion. That's his city. And we'll look at, you know, the prophecies concerning that in a moment. You have come to the city of the living God. He's not a dead God like the pagans worship. You know, he is a God that was the God for the Israelites. He's the same God that's the God for the Christians. He's living. He's ongoing. He's forever. And this is his city. It is the new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem. The old Jerusalem was just a type, a shadow of what was developed. The new Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem, is filled only with God's people. And I'll explain that. To myriads of angels. See, that's part of this. You know, we have a tendency to think of the church as just a gathering of people here. You know, there's something going on. Yeah, the church kind of hovers between heaven and hell, or heaven and earth. Okay, there's something physical about it, but there's also something vastly spiritual about it. Just as Christians, you know, you have a physical body here, but there's something inside of you that's purely heavenly. The Spirit of God within you. So you're kind of caught between the two. You got to think of it as being suspended. Like if you went out that door, you wouldn't see the earth or anything. You know, we're just kind of right now. You know, something closer to God than anything else in this world. Myriads of angels are involved in this. Now, the word myriad in the Greek means 10,000. I think, well, you know, 10,000 angels. Now, for them, that was the greatest number that they worked with. So for them, myriad was the same as our infinity. That's the joke with Buzz Lightyear to infinity and beyond. What's beyond infinity? Nothing. We would see, you know, infinities, you know, put a plural on it to describe, you know, something that you cannot count ever. Well, that's what they're doing here. Myriads. It's plural. Myriad should do it, but because it's pluralized, it's going, you can't count the number of angels that are involved in this. This is the connection we have in the church, in the city of God with them. Now, the city, though, back to chapter 11, for he, Abraham, notice it says, he was looking for the city which has foundation, whose architect and builder is God. That's what Abraham was looking for. That's what the Jews should have been looking for. Not something physical, something that God had promised even Abraham. Okay? Same chapter, goes on a little bit longer, says, for those who say such things, say what? Well, that we're just strangers, pilgrims, sojourners here. Nothing permanent. Not looking at the world. You know, and this is something we have to get through our head. You know, for whatever you find fascinating in this time, you know, whether you know the sports or you know family or whatever drags you away from services. I mean, sometimes the numbers you know at attendance you know at the assembly go way down. For what? I mean, we've all got excuses: work, family, sports, you know, whatever. We've got to have recreation, you know, this kind of stuff. There is nothing that's important. Your iPods, your American Idols, whatever. There is nothing more important than being in the presence of God here and assembled with Him. Because of all you're assembled with. So they made it clear that they seek a country of their own. Not anything on this planet. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they'd went out, they would have had opportunity to return. They would have found an excuse. They would have been like Lot's wife looking back on Sodom. You know, what was she thinking? But rather, so where they desire a better country that is a heavenly one, where God dwells. This is what should be going through our thoughts. To a general assembly in church of the firstborn. Okay, that word general assembly. Okay, if you're following in your Bibles, if you've got a new international version, notice it doesn't say general assembly. It says festal assembly. You know, exuberant, joyful, whatever. There's a passage in the New Testament that goes, there's more joy in heaven for, you know, one sinner that repents. Okay, this festal assembly should go with the previous verse and the myriads of angels. That's what they're doing. It's just not a bunch of angels milling around doing nothing. They're festal assemblies of angels. Exuberant because of all that God has made possible. You know, through the death of his son, all those in the Old Testament that were found worthy are now part of this. And all the new ones that are being lined up. This is what the following passages begin to describe. Why are these angels so exuberant, exultant, happy, partying, you know, whatever? Because you have come to the ecclesia, the church of the firstborn. We've covered this just recently. This is not Christ. Okay. Now, he is described as the first one in Colossians and other places, but this is the one instance where literally it says firstborn ones in the Greek, which you can see in the English because I've underlined it, who are, not yeah, who is, but who are. Okay. Who are enrolled in heaven. Now, this is the transition. Okay. This is not like you'll see the last part of this verse. These are the ones who have their names enrolled and they're prepared to go. That's the church. Among us, there should be, hopefully all of us, our names are enrolled in heaven. As people that have accepted the covenant of God, the grace of God, and are living their lives so that they don't look back on this world, they're looking for the one to come. Because we've come to God, the judge of all. This is how they got that way, how they can be determined that way. As sinners, and we still are sinners, how can we come to God? That's what makes this gathering so special. Christ made it special. Our sins, Isaiah said, separated us from God. As a sinner, you can't approach God. You'd be just as destroyed as anyone that tried to approach the mountain at Zion, at Sinai. How do you get past the barrier? The blood of Christ, and that's explained too. And because God now, who judges all impartially, looks at those who have received the covenant promises and are willing to be obedient to God's, you know, to God's law. And he has determined them forensically, judged them to be appropriately enrolled in heaven. And there's those that have already made it. The spirits of righteous men who have become perfected, mature, complete, that have died the blessed death of service to God, and they're there already. And that's what the angels are happy about. That's a growing number. And they can see more potential ones in the church here on earth waiting to go up. Notice this. You know, this enrollment is something that goes back to the prophets. Isaiah 43, and it will come about that he who is left in Zion and remains in Jerusalem will be called holy. He's talking about the future now. Everyone who is recorded for life in Jerusalem. Okay. There's a big deal about having your name recorded in this book. In Luke 10, 20, Jesus talking to his disciples. I mean, they've gone out, he's given the Spirit, and they're casting out demons, and they're all happy about it. He goes, that the demons are subject to you, don't rejoice in that, but rejoice that your names are recorded in heaven. That's what made them special. It's just disciples. That's what they should have been happy about. Their situation with God was far different than it was before they met Jesus Christ. Philippians 4:3, Paul says, I ask you also to help these women who have shared my struggle in the cause of the gospel, together with Clement also, and the rest of my fellow workers whose names are in the book of life. That's how you can tell Christians, you know, from non-Christians. Their name's in the book. Revelation talks about 21:27, nothing unclean and no one who practices abomination and lying shall ever come into it, the city, but only those whose names are written in the Lamb's book of life. Who's the book of life belong to? Christ, the Lamb. Now this book is his in the Old Testament and the New. And for those who think that, well, once saved, always saved, if your name's in the book, you know, you're there. Yeah, go back to Moses again. As he's trying to argue for, you know, on the behalf of the people, he says, but now, talking to God, if thou wilt forgive their sin, and if not, please blot me out of the book. Take me instead. If me giving myself over, I can take their place, do it. But notice God's answer. whoever has sinned against me, I will blot him out of my book. Nobody can do it for you. You have to be right with God. If you sin against God, he will blot you out. You can lose your salvation. You can lose your recognition. And you've also come to Jesus. And this is the whole point. The mediator, the propitiator, the advocate for us, the high priest now for us. Yeah, the writer's getting on all of these. He's the one that's made it possible to bring men to God. The mediator of a new covenant, Neah, new in the sense that it's far better. Not just a replacement, it's not just a different covenant, it's a far better one. That's been the whole argument through this, you know, this writing of the Hebrews. The old one was obsolete and fading, even as it started talking about a new one. And the new one's far better, because the blood of bulls and goats under the oil couldn't take away sin. But the blood of Christ could. And he gets into this. Notice this sprinkled blood, which speaks better than the blood of Abel. Now when Cain killed Abel, this is Genesis, the fourth chapter, it says that the blood of Abel screamed from the ground for vengeance. Now we have the blood of Christ, which is far better. Kratel, I think, is the word. Superior. Because it doesn't just, you know, talk of retribution. It talks of cleansing, propitiation, reconciliation. All the things that the blood of Christ does in order to make it possible for us to come back to God. Does far more. Does far more. Now notice this imagery the Hebrew writer gets into. He says, for when the commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and the goats. This is what he dipped the hyssop in their blood, and he sprinkled everything. He sprinkled the tabernacle, the items in it, the people. Everybody got cleansed. Same imagery. The blood of Christ was taken. Who took it? Probably himself. And sprinkled on those souls that have come to him. All things are cleansed by blood. So the writer says in Hebrews 10:22, let us draw near with a sincere heart in full assurance of faith, having our hearts sprinkled clean from an evil conscience and our bodies washed with pure water. We've made this claim before, you know, in baptism, where we, you know, try to get people, get immersed. Okay? It may be just an outward thing in the sense of a washing of the body, but there's something else going on a different plane, a mystical plane, you know, a super mundane plane. Somewhere, somehow, the blood of Christ is being sprinkled on your conscience and on your heart. So while you're being baptized, you're also being cleansed spiritually. John 9:14, how much more with the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve this living God we're talking about. Okay. Now, getting to the last portion of this down to the end of the chapter, not involved, and it's just kind of ending up, you know, the presentation, you know, with some things that the writer himself wanted to emphasize. First of all, you know, the emphasis of being blotted out. You know, the book itself talks about, you know, first of all, Hebrews 2, how can we escape if we neglect so great a salvation? See to it that you do not refuse him as speaking, for if those did not escape when they refused him and warned them on earth. I mean, this is what Hebrews 2 begins with. If those that violated the law of Moses were punished, what about those who violate the law of Christ? When he talks about, yet once more I will shake not only the earth but also the heaven, yeah, that's one thing to keep in mind in this, on how special, you know, we've got it. But also to keep in mind on your salvation too, and, you know, not taking lightly this great privilege that you've been given. Come on. You may need more batteries in this thing. Notice in chapter 6, For in the case of those that had once been enlightened and tasted of the heavenly gift and have been partakers of the Holy Spirit, the good work of God, the powers of the age to come, and then have fallen away. I mean, it's easy to, you can fall away from your relationship with God. Yeah. You can turn your back on it. He's talking about the individuals that had everything. They had the Spirit. They could do the power. They see the wonders. They see all that God has done in their life. If you can walk away from that, he says it's impossible to bring you to repentance. You think, well, anybody can repent. No, they can't. You can get to a point of a mind that's reprobate, a conscience that's depraved, seared, well, that nothing that God can say to you will make a difference. You know, you've chosen after seeing it all and think it's nothing special, and you go back into the world. You'd rather have the pleasures of sin for a season than the glory of the promises of God. There's no way you can come back. Or, as he moves up into the 10th chapter, how much severe punishment do you think he will deserve who is trampled on the foot? The Son of God has regarded as unclean the blood of the covenant by which he was sanctified and has insulted the Spirit of grace. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. He's a consuming fire. He was warning the Jews, don't go back to Sinai. There's nothing there for you. It's a fearful thing. Where they couldn't approach God, now as Christians, you can approach God in a nearer form than the high priest of the Jews ever could. As your judge, you can go before God and lay your request, before him. That he might have an influence in your life. You have special things in your relationship with your living God, which they did not have. But if you turn around, we can do the same thing, even though we're not Jews or Jewish Christians, as Gentile Christians. We can look at what God has given us, not really taking it in as to how important it is, and turn ourselves back into the world. You've trampled underfoot the Son of God. You've walked over him. You've nailed him to the cross again. You're as guilty as those who did it in the first century. And you think God's going to smile on you and say, no big deal? We need to be as fearful as they were at Sinai. This is why this expression, yet once more, denotes the shaking of things which can be shaken as created things. I mean, God shook the earth at Sinai. He says, once more I'm going to shake things up. But it's not going to be just a mountain. It's going to be the whole earth. It's going to be the heavens themselves. Everything's going to be shaken, and they're going to disappear. Where do you need to be? The one place that can't be shaken, Mount Zion. That's the only safe place in this whole world, especially as the end approaches. The only place that can't be shaken. The only firm foundation. In fact, Paul says, there's no foundation that anyone can lay other than Jesus Christ. You need to be on him. No other prophet, no other lawgiver can do it for you. No scientist, no politician, whatever. You need to take a firm stand on the only thing that's going to get you into the next realm. You've already got one foot toward there, suspended between heaven and earth among the assembly of the saints. And the last warning, by which we may offer to God an acceptable service with reverence. Reverence is a clean way of saying with fear. Because our God's a consuming God. We need to take God seriously. We need to take his church seriously. Okay? Christ died for the church. He took it seriously. He came to earth, gave up a lot of things in order to build the church. Okay? This is the assembly of the saints. If we've kept it pure, if we've done our job, if we have behaved ourselves properly as a royal priesthood. There's all sorts of warnings in the scriptures to not take it lightly and to do what needs to be done to ensure that, when the final time comes, you're ready to meet your maker. If there's anything we can do to help, please let us know as we stand to sing.